Right, thank you everyone. That's all right. Good evening. Thank you for turning out on this absolutely freezing night. And first, two apologies. I'm not George Lawson, who was meant to chair this meeting. I'm a quickly assembled understudy, Toby Dodge, but like George Lawson, I teach in the International Relations Department, and I'm joined by a stellar cast, Mukhalika Banerjee, who is the director of the South Asia Centre here, Firdevs Robinson, who's a London-based journalist who's covered international affairs for over three decades, and my old friend Robert Singh, who's a professor in Birkbeck College, University of London. Now, we're here tonight to celebrate the life and times of an old friend of a lot of us and a colleague of ours, Fred Halliday, who tragically died at the age of 64 of cancer in April 2010. And I was sitting in one of these annual events some years ago when it struck me that people may not have known actually who Fred Halliday was. And I think it's good to judge the size of his character and the range of his capacities, that when he died, he had to be replaced with not one job, but potentially three, because firstly, he was a world-renowned professor of international relations and helped bolster and expand the international relations department here. Secondly, how I knew him, he was a professor of Middle East politics and helped set up the Center for Middle East Studies that I now run. But thirdly, and probably unofficially, but equally importantly, we could have called him a professor of public engagement. And when we assessed his life after he died, he published in numerous newspapers, journal articles, and books. And I picked five or six of the most influential books on me to give you a sense of who he is. Firstly, Arabia Without Sultans, that he published in 1974, Call for Revolution in the Persian Gulf, Iran, Dictatorship and Development in 78, on the eve of the revolution in Iran, The Making of the Second Cold War, study of Reagan, amongst others, in 1983, Rethinking International Relations, probably the most influential book of his that I've read, Islam and the Myth of Confrontation, 2 Hours That Shook the World, about 9/11, and I think probably his latest and most coherent book in terms of its contribution to both international relations and Middle East, published by Cambridge in 2005, The Middle East in International Relations, Power, Politics, and Ideology. So the idea of these series of lectures, one a year, this round table, is to pick issues or topics that would have interested Fred, that would have animated him, and bring together a series of academics, public intellectuals, journalists to shed light on it. So the idea here is to consider populism, to consider it not just as something that may have arrived in Britain recently with the Brexit vote, may have arrived with Trump in the United States, but is a truly global phenomenon. And so against that background, populism has a long history. Modern populism is usually traced back to the 19th century, the People's Party in the United States, or the Russian Narodniks. Theories about it abound, but if I were looking at it, I'd say it's central. It's an attack on the perceived elite, an attack on the failures of political liberalism, but also a kind of wider mistrust of institutions, blamed very often and probably rightly on the spreading hegemonic ideology of neoliberalism. But it's also, I think, we can see it in the decline of class politics, in a kind of rising ideology that speaks for the common person, but often is promoted by people like who are fairly wealthy and are using the mobilization of the population for their own ends. And I think why this would be interesting to Fred Halliday, because I think to his bootstraps, he wasn't a populist. He was a militant cosmopolitan and universalist who often attacked the slipshod thinking, shorthand, and kind of ideologically deceptive trends that are at work in populism. So we have three speakers, Mukhalika, Firdevs and Robert. I think Mukhalika is going to go first, and I would assume tackle populism in South Asia. So without further ado, Mukhalika.
Thank you, and thank you all for coming. I joined LSE the year just before Fred died. So I didn't actually, and this being the LSE, I'm an anthropologist. I worked in the anthropology department. I never came across Fred, but I'd read him as a grad student, and it's very nice to be connected to an event to remember and celebrate his work. And I think it's entirely appropriate that we start a discussion on populism this evening by not looking to Euro-America, but actually looking to a different part of the world to understand the phenomenon. In doing so, we attempt not just to understand populism in India, but to understand the nature of populism itself. It's a perspective that determines academic research in different parts of the world, which is not about learning just about that part of the world, but about how engaging deeply with an issue in some particular continent or country actually helps you understand the concept itself. Especially, as Toby said in his opening remarks, that when there is very easily a supposition that a word like populism or democracy are words that are somehow tied to certain parts of the world. There's a copyright on, for instance, democracy being some Euro-American concept, even though we cannot find two countries in Euro-America that actually have similar kinds of democracies. It's a very varied phenomenon wherever we find it. So it's in that spirit I want to sort of share some thoughts on where populism is in India. And I say that word because that's what the roundtable is called. But I don't find it a very useful term at all. It is a very plural concept. As we know, you can have left and right wing populisms and populists. What we do know, and we seem to agree across the literature on the fact that they often are centered around individuals, and there is an attack and a bypassing of institutional structures, and usually liberal institutions, which are challenged by populists. I find it much more productive to think of populist, rather than think of populism as some sort of ideological noun, to think of a populist style as an adjective to describe a certain kinds of politics where it becomes very productive. You can think about it in a number of different contexts. Indeed, you can think about varying phases in a long political career in a single individual where they may have a populist turn in certain measures. You can talk about certain policies as populist and so on. So I think populist is probably, to my mind at least, a more useful term to think with. But what I think even people who detract, I don't write about populism myself, but the people who do and theorize about it seem to agree that there is something about the connect between a leader and their followers that is a direct connection between them that lies at the heart of this populist appeal. And the bypassing of institutions is very important. And what that bypassing is for is usually what makes it very context specific. The context determines the agenda of why institutions need to be bypassed. Now, I'm reading this, unrelated. There's a very interesting new book. I don't know if anyone's seen this. It's just come out, called The Great Regression, which is really an excellent collection of essays, thinking and, slightly provocatively titled, to think about what's happening in the world and can we bring, in fact, is there a zeitgeist of the 21st century that is about this particular blend of populist styles that we are seeing across the globe? And so if you go west to east, if you think of the US, who Robin's going to speak about, you think about various populisms of Western Europe, which is closer home and familiar to many of us, moving further east to Turkey, Russia, and then India. But there are several other examples, and this collection of essays brings these together. Now, what they're arguing, which is very useful, is to whether we can think of a certain set of global technologies, a certain set of global mechanisms that have created a common zeitgeist. It has something to do, we know, with neoliberalism. We know it has something to do with globalization. These are words that come up. But they're also linked very directly to issues of migration, of terrorism, of climate change. And so then you get these words like securitization, you get inequality, you get fragile states, you get austerity, you get law and order. And it seems to me that each of the contexts that we are discussing this evening and elsewhere creates a bricolage of these elements combined in different ways to in that particular context. Now, I want to bring the sort of, you know, that's my brief anyway for the evening, to talk about this kind of what the bricolage looks like in the Indian case in this combination of factors. And here the argument that Arjun Appadurai makes here is a very persuasive one. It certainly works for India and possibly elsewhere, that whatever the economic factors may be, and remember, in India, there was no financial crisis. The 2008 financial crisis did not create the turmoil it did in the West. And India continues to grow, at its growth rate figures continue between 5 and 6%. So it's a very different economic scenario to what we hear about in Europe and North America. But what you do have, even in India, is inevitably, because no country is exempt from it, is a complete loss of economic sovereignty. Governments no longer control the economy in the way that they perhaps at least pretended to, and to a large extent did in the past. And therefore, this lack of control of running a national economy with a certain degree of autonomy has disappeared. And this desire for control has really translated into a creation of a cultural sovereignty. So all of that impulse for control in a society that feels completely tossed about on the high seas of whether it's global capitalism, but also the financialization of the economy, which has made economic processes totally opaque, literally, to most people, has to be that impulse for control is turned entirely inwards towards a cultural nationalism, a cultural sovereignty, to control the terms of national debate on these. Now, in India, what happened was in 2014, the Bharatiya Janata Party, the BJP, came to power. Its prime minister is Narendra Modi, a name. Has anyone heard of Narendra Modi in this room? Okay, so he's a bit hard to miss. He wherever he goes, he has a propensity to hug all world leaders, sometimes willing, you know, who are willing, sometimes looking rather awkward. He made a big splash in Davos a couple of weeks ago, which was, again, an interesting, I'll talk about that if somebody wants to, and the annual budget of the government came out 10 days afterwards, and they were completely, exactly the opposite message of what he said in Davos and what he did in the national budget, but we can talk about that if you want. It sort of exemplifies what I'm saying. So he came to power on this huge majority in parliament of a kind that India hadn't seen for a while. But the vote share was 31%. So he didn't, every Indian didn't vote for the Bharatiya Janata Party, only a third of Indians did, but it was very symptomatic of how well they play the electoral game. And again, this is something we can talk about if you want. He's a member of a grassroots Hindutva organization called the RSS, the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh. The RSS, a member of the RSS assassinated Mahatma Gandhi. That's how people, if you would have heard of the RSS, that's why you should have heard of it. The Prime Minister of India belongs to that organization still. He was, his political apprenticeship and membership has been in the RSS. And the RSS and Hindutva is exactly the opposite of the constitutional imagination of India. So India's constitution in 1947, when it gains independence from colonialism, is of a republic that is secular, that is diverse, and which has universal suffrage. So the gamble that India makes in 1947 is actually to democratize the idea of democracy for the first time. A country does this, where it's poor, illiterate. The whole world tells India it's completely mad to give everybody the vote, but they decide to do it, the founding fathers, so to speak, of India. Lots of women, too, actually, in the Constituent Assembly. They imagine an India where everybody starts off as a sovereign citizen and where there is an aspiration to, therefore, giving everybody democratic rights, of celebrating diversity, so it also challenges Europeans' one nation, one language model of nationalism. It is, in fact, an immensely plural and diverse country with over 300 languages and lots of regions and lots of variety. And it also makes a commitment in its sort of mixed economy model to development for the last person. So it's very aware in its new imagination that this new nation is there for the poorest Indian. So what is going to be designed economically must always keep that in mind as the development agenda. Again, it sort of therefore sort of bypasses hegemonic discourses of modernization and so on that come slightly later in the 60s and 70s, but very much in the air of some sort of teleological progress to India becoming like Europe, which rejects and creates a new trajectory for itself. Now, I would argue that, and I'm not alone, of course, that Hindutva as an ideology, which is the ideology of the ruling party, is an attack on all these constitutional visions of this constitutional vision of India. It has attacked the democratic commitment to universal suffrage. I mean, I write a lot about elections and why people engage with voting. So I think about this a lot. But it has, in the last 4 years, since 2014, there has been more interference and attack of the Election Commission of India and actually a stuffing of right-wing sympathizers of the BJP in the Election Commission than ever before on India's record. Now, this is particularly galling because India has got a lot of things wrong. There's human development indicators are hideous. Malnutrition is higher than sub-Saharan Africa. It's a schizophrenic story of high economic growth rates, well-educated, wealthy Indians the world over, and yet the majority of the Indian population living in utter, not only poverty, but extreme violence. Sorry, I've lost my thought. The stuffing, so the electoral machinery, which has in fact been one of the few success stories of India, that's what I was talking about, that it's been a failure on a number of other measures. But the one thing it's done well has actually been able to run reasonably free and fair elections given the scale of Indian elections. And that has been systematically attacked, such that one can almost make an argument, and I would, that elections have been used to get rid of democracy. Suddenly, to my mind, elections are bad for democracy in the way that they have been used by the BJP. And we, again, if anyone wants to talk more about it, I'd be delighted to. The second aspect, democracy was the first, diversity, the second commitment, the constitutional vision to diversity. It's the first time in the Indian parliament that there is not a single Muslim MP in the leading party, which has so many hundreds of votes in the Indian parliament. Muslims are 16% of the population. This is a large majority. The largest number of, you know, India has more Muslims living in it than Pakistan does, because it, just by sheer numbers, it's the Muslim population is a very sizable one, but a very neglected one and a very impoverished one. And they're missing from the legislature. They're not given seats that they're likely, tickets to seats that they're likely to win. And finally, the development agenda has been, particularly, again, in the last 3 years, there has been a dismantling. Just one example, a dismantling of more environmental laws in the last 3 years than we've had before, such that mining companies and others with interests in displacing various populations at the bottom of the heap have had complete carte blanche. And of course, this also takes absolutely no cognizance of the implications for the environment or climate change and so on. So there's a dismantling of the constitutional commitments to India such that this kind of politics can threaten what India as a democracy has stood for, however imperfectly. Now, this has been very much the result of Narendra Modi as an individual being immensely popular. And this is so this is no autocrat that everybody hates. This is not a dictator that everybody can see through. People genuinely love him and admire him. I don't know about love, because he's a man who's incapable of love from what we can tell. You know, as a brilliant Ashish Nandi commented on him, how can you trust a man who's never loved? He has this slightly odd personal life. And he's always been a very singular, isolated, lonely figure. But he is admired by Indians in India and the world over. The people who, I was amongst the 60,000 at Wembley Stadium 2 years ago to watch him address the crowd with David Cameron riding on his coattails. But, I mean, when is Cameron ever going to get a crowd of 60,000, eh? So he was there for the party and loved it. But people genuinely wanted to be present. They wanted to hear him, and he is a brilliant orator. I went really as a political anthropologist, not as a supporter, just to hear political oratory of that quality, which you don't get in the West at all, I dare say. I voted every British election. It's a long time since I've heard a politician play with words in the way that, you know, it's much more, it's closer to Cicero's ideas than what we hear in the sort of humdrum press conferences that we get to hear. But here's a man who never is accountable. He's never held accountable. He's never held a press conference in 4 years. And I'll wrap up. I have a couple of minutes for you, no? Is that what? The sad thing is we've lost some panelists. The good thing is that we have a little bit more time than we originally were. But I won't take up too much of this. But I think the three key things that I think will certainly, knowing what I do about Turkey, what the overlap here, is the point I was making earlier is that this destruction of the constitutional vision, this challenge that you get, is the result of that old-fashioned notion of hegemony. It really is. There is a complete, people are not upset about this. People are quite happy to go along with it. And the challenge for us is to explain why it is so comforting to have this kind of cultural, chauvinistic cultural nationalism, which is against minorities, which is about creating an image of the nation that is unsullied by the impurities of minorities or of poor, disenfranchised, socially disenfranchised Dalits. It is the violence that you get on an everyday basis in India is precisely against these categories of people, and it's literally become everyday. So the vision of Hindutva is that vision of the nation, what I call the reclaiming of cultural sovereignty. And mind you, so I have been using the word Hindutva and not Hindu. Now, they often tend to say they're speaking in the name of Hindus, but they're not really. I mean, they're not. In fact, a lot of the top leadership of the BJP are really quite imperfect and bad Hindus. They wouldn't know very basic things about Hinduism if you were to ask them. But they're appealing to a political majority with a cultural sovereignty argument. And the three, and I said populism or populist styles of leadership require these attacks on institutions, and the three starkest ones, which are the ones who are most likely to challenge this kind of hegemonic consensus around agreeing to this dismantling of the constitutional framework, are the courts, which are now, there's a real battle on in the Supreme Court of India at the moment, which has for the first time gone public. With a very interesting story, again, one I can talk about later. The second is the media itself. So he doesn't take questions from anyone. Nobody asks Narendra Modi any questions or not. He talks at people. So there's a monthly radio show, very much like Chavez used to do. So it's called Man Ki Baat, What's in My Mind, What's in My Heart, and he talks at people for hours, and people love it. But nobody can come back to him. And if you look at the ownership of media houses in India, they're all owned by two or three companies very close to Narendra Modi, which is creating a sort of self-censorship, homogenized content, which is unprecedented in the Indian press. The Indian press was rather vibrant. We've had a period of 2 years, 18 months, 19 months in 75-77 when Indira Gandhi, who actually under Narendra Modi is most like, had suspended democratic rights. But there was a suspension. and there was censorship. So you knew there was censorship. Now, what we find in India is a so-called functioning democracy, where actually the democratic institutions and spirit is completely destroyed or under threat. And universities and spaces where you might actually have a discussion like this, for instance, simply would not be tolerated anymore. So there are attacks on academic freedom and freedom of thought. And if, say, my last 10 minutes, what I've said, would be branded as anti-national. Somehow that this was a threat to the Indian nation to have a cool analytical frame held up to its record. Master. So I'm going to just stop with that.
Okay, great. So thank you very much. So what I'm hearing at the moment is a demand for cultural sovereignty, an anti-diversity, an anti-democracy, an anti-institutionalism, and something around the comforts of chauvinism. So, any echoes in Turkey?
Well, before I come to Turkey, I feel quite fortunate because I interviewed Modi in 2009 elections, because I covered Indian elections on a train for 2 weeks in Ahmedabad. And he did take our questions then, so they do perhaps change quite considerably. I also feel quite fortunate that I recovered well enough from my chest infection today. I've been on my back all week to be with you and remember Fred. With Fred, I met as a young journalist in my early 20s. I remember interviewing him, I think, about Iraq. I'm not 100% sure what it was. It was something about Middle East, and I was quite terrified of him right from the start. But over the years, when I got to know him better, he became quite an example of an intellectual and actually quite a kind man. So I do remember him with great affection and respect. I will try to stick to my 12-13 minutes, and I will probably try to keep it to Turkey, and then perhaps we could discuss the wider issues around Turkey, around India, and other countries. Turkey and several other countries where populism gained ground in recent years have actually very different political landscapes, but they still share a surprising number of features. And right from the start, I would say that populism has been a defining element of the AKP, Justice and Development Party, in Turkey, and its leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Like many other populists, the AKP had a majoritarian understanding of democracy. We are the people, who are you? Erdogan quite frequently asks. The nation now in Turkey is made up of those who stand with the AKP, and they are, of course, the moral majority. What matters is the national will. And the criticism of others are either dismissed or they become totally irrelevant. Like populists elsewhere, Mr. Erdogan is highly divisive and polarizing. Winning elections entitles the strong and paternalistic leader to change the fate of the nation. And he is the voice of the voiceless masses. He knows how they feel. He knows what they want, and he knows how far they want him to go. And you know, he's actually quite right. He really does know what they want. Except, of course, you know, he is one of them. He's due to his humble beginnings in life, and he walks like them. He talks like them, and perhaps he doesn't live like them anymore. But he is certainly seen as one of them. Turkey's populists have a skewed and glorified view of the past. They are sometimes overly optimistic, But they are very confident that they will actually have a very big, bright, even more glorified future ahead of them. They practically destroyed independent media. They undermined the media. They undermined the independent judiciary. I would say they probably finished the independent judiciary. And they certainly demonize their political opponents. They attack key institutions and they remove all oversight in the country. Even at the height of their power, they still claim victimhood. Everything that goes wrong is blamed on others, either inside the country or outside the country, those that conspire against them. So the parallels between Turkey and elsewhere are quite striking. But to my mind, even more interesting side of this discussion is the differences, really. They are the differences that matter to me a little bit more. Populism in Turkey is not a political phenomenon that just emerged with the arrival of the AKP. State building and nation building at the same time, the Kemalist, right from the beginning, made the concept of people as sovereign entity as their founding principle. Rapid and radical top-down modernization in a war-torn, largely illiterate, multi-ethnic society required an iron fist as well as a very strong political populism of a kind. It was all done for the people, despite the people. In creating the Turkish nation state and defining Turkish identity, being Muslim was the important, the main criteria in Turkey. Kurds, Caucasians, people from the Balkans, non-Turkish speaking Greeks, they all became Turks. They were considered Turks. And non-Muslims who lived on the land for centuries all of a sudden became minorities. The period between 1950 and 1960, it was the beginning of the multi-party system in Turkey, and that brought Turkey's first truly populist leader, Adnan Menderes, to power. He served three terms as prime minister. Menderes had massive support from religiously conservative rural populations in Turkey, and he, sure enough, delivered his promise of easing the curbs on religious practice. But Menderes soon turned authoritarian. He brutally crushed political opposition, anti-government protests, he targeted non-Muslim minorities, and he jailed journalists. He too was polarizing and very vindictive. Even small villages, people, I remember my grandparents talking about it when I was a child. People even in smallest communities, in villages, separated their coffee shops. There was one shop for supporters of Democrat Party and another shop for the supporters of the Republican People's Party. 1960 military coup brought an end to this crude system, majoritarian system of Menderes and Democrat Party to an end. With a new constitution expanding human rights, individual rights and liberties, Turkey had a relatively short period of a constrained democracy. 20 years later, and with another military intervention in between, the 1980 military coup crushed the left mainly and also contained the extreme right in Turkey. And despite their very aggressive Kemalist narrative, the the leader of the coup, Kenan Evren, and his generals opened a space for Islamist movements in Turkey to thrive many more decades after them. And in the absence of left and in this stifling militaristic nationalist environment, Turkey's Kurds looked for their own networks. And this is the time the PKK, Kurdistan Workers' Party, insurgency started in Turkey. And the conservative, mostly rural population, on the other hand, found their voice in Islamist movements and various Islamist parties. In 2002, the AKP won its first parliamentary elections as a conservative democratic party of the center. And that was a few years after a major earthquake and soon after Turkey's worst economic crisis. So the AKP successfully mobilized popular discontent, and the voters were really fed up with inefficient and corrupt coalition governments, and they practically buried existing leaders. The AKP at that time, both in Turkey and outside, was hailed as exemplary moderate Muslim Democrats. They promised a clean government, a well-run economy, and social justice. They advocated free markets, equal citizenship, human rights, free speech, and religious freedom. And of course, these are all things that the European Union expected of its candidate countries, and the AKP wanted to join the European Union. Contrary to popular view, the AKP's approach was more of an accommodation rather than confrontation. And if you take that at face value, this is hardly populism as we understand it now. Now, I don't have much more time really to go into how Mr. Erdogan's authoritarian turn since the 2010 referendum and post-Gezi events manifest itself in today's Turkey. But in any case, I think you all know that Turkey today is the biggest jailer of journalists. This year, Turkey ranked 101st out of 113 countries in the World Justice Project's Rule of Law Index. And the Washington-based Freedom House said in 2018 report, during the past decade, the most dramatic decline of freedoms happened in Turkey, and Turkey was no longer a free country. If you want more, the World Economic Forum says Turkey's standing in secondary educational ranking, which was 91st in 2008, fell back to 105th place in 2016 and 2017. So, to sum it up, cultural, political, and national populism had existed in Turkey long before the rise of the AKP, and the AKP presents this continuity. The common threads that run among the AKP and the populist parties before are the Turkish nationalism, authoritarianism, and Sunni Islam. And AKP, of course, the product of its time, you have to read Islam there for AKP as political Islam. By the time the AKP appeared on political scene, the network of Islamist brotherhoods and various movements were already very well established throughout the country in Turkey, although they were not as visible. Various religious communities mobilizing their followers supported political parties, influenced the outcome of elections starting from 1950s. In fact, they made fortunes of leaders like conservative Süleyman Demirel to staunchly secular Bülent Ecevit. The Fethullah Gülen movement, in particular Fethullah Gülen movement, had already become entrenched in the judiciary, in the police, and to a lesser extent in military, well before the AKP existed as a party. And they were very strong in education and in bureaucracy. As for ethnic nationalism, this is one common thread that runs through secularists, Islamists, the left and the right. In true Islamist fashion, the AKP really espoused the concept of Islamic Brotherhood sort of as their solution to deal with the Kurdish problem. But they had to abandon it fairly soon because neither the Turks nor the Kurds really bought it. Turkey's Islamist in general and the AKP in particular did not really want to destroy the establishment. On the contrary, they wanted to be in it. They wanted to be fully in charge of this very same establishment. And for his followers, Mr. Erdogan represents, more than anything else, the strong state. So, what generalizable lessons that we can draw about the kind of populism that we have experienced in Turkey? Excuse me. I would say, listen to what they are saying about themselves and about others. And how many of us really took Mr. Erdogan seriously when he uttered very early in his leadership, when he said, democracy is a train, you get off it when you reach your destination. The second thing that I would take from Turkish experience is that not to assume that populists will be tamed when they come to government. Some of them do, some of them don't. Many of them, in fact, don't. And don't predict that they would not have the capacity and human capital to govern, and don't sit back and wait for them to fail. And do not invest so much hope in the disappearance, naturally or otherwise, of the strong leader. Because by the time that you're no longer able to dislodge that person off by democratic means, the transformation of the regime is already finished. And the system will replace one strong leader with another one. I really urge everyone to pay attention, to close attention to education. In Turkey, in early years of AKP government, changes were taking place, really radical changes were taking place in education, right from the start. I remember doing a Radio 4 documentary in 2007 and interviewing Bosphorus University and other leading professors, academics in Turkey's best universities. And I remember talking to a genetics professor complaining that you know, they were already replacing books with creationist glossy books of Harun Yahya or the infamous Adnan Hoca, Adnan Oktay. So it's been going on for a long time, so don't take your eye off education. Equally, watch and resist the erosion of women's rights and their status in society. And finally, I don't know whether you will agree with me or not, as a journalist now, speaking as a journalist, I would say, please, please, do not explain and analyze countries in essentialist terms. Templates don't very often fit countries like Turkey, India, and others.
Thank you very much. So we're hearing some strong comparisons with India, but also some differences. Continuity and not a watershed, but attacking the media. A huge skill in being able to talk to and for the population, a kind of claimed victimhood, but a polarizing, polemicizing discourse. Now, Rob, I suspect you're going to tell us that populism doesn't explain Donald Trump, but let me call upon you to tell us all about Donald Trump and the lack of populism.
Stole my thunder, Toby.
I apologize.
Thanks very much, and thanks for the invitation to come here. I've got some new friends towards the end of this time, and I think, as Toby said, he'd be skeptical of populism. And so am I. I think understanding populism suffers from too much attention on Trump in the United States. And too little attention on some of the cases where populism actually isn't an influence. Japan and Canada, for example, two very different cases, one with a highly restrictive immigration policy and high levels of protectionism, the other with a great deal of immigrant integration and effective safety net and economic liberalism. So I think generalizing is difficult. I wrote an article in Economy and Society last summer in which I tried to make three points about Trump. I usually only get released into the community when I'm being contrarian, so I'll repeat them now. One is that Trump reveals more about populism than populism does about him. He illustrates populism's conceptual elasticity, but employing it as a frame to understand him imposes coherence upon a figure whose monetized politics are chaotic, shallow, and unanchored by principle. Secondly, that populism provides a necessary but insufficient condition for critically explaining his rise. And thirdly, his constitutional threat in power is less than meets his ubiquitous eye. So I want to, as academics usually do, stand by what I wrote and say I've been proven right, to make four points, hopefully a little bit on that while keeping to the time, on history, proportionality, polarization, and populism in power. The history, I think I would tend to agree with Jan Werner Muller's argument that populism is an ever-present shadow in democratic politics rather than some kind of alien element. And the United States is the exemplar of that. The US relationship with populism has really been coterminous since its founding. You have no other state that could have the audacity to begin its preamble to its constitution with the term "we the people," having been written by 55 elitists, and something which institutionalizes referenda across most states. In 2006, Arizona approved allowing pregnant pigs a minimum amount of living space, while Michigan declined to repeal a law repealing the hunting of mourning doves. Every state except Delaware requires proposed amendments to its state constitution to be put to the people in a referendum. Recalls, petitions, political communications, and a general default position of running for Washington by running against Washington, not running against the government, but running against government, transcends partisan differences. So the founders really wanted to be governed by an elite, not a hereditary elite, but an elite of the virtuous and the talented. And ever since, there has been a constant tension between their vision and the democratization steadily of the United States. Tocqueville wrote in Democracy in America that in America, the people are a master who must be indulged to the utmost possible limits. Well, 1835 was rather a long time before Trump arrived. The second element I'd like to emphasize is proportionality. It seems to me that there's a great deal of hysteria, some of it at a moderate level justified, but too much of it not justified over the Trump phenomenon. There was no golden age when populism was never present, never employed in a nativist form, in a vulgar form, if you like. But 2016, to my mind, saw no populist revolution in America, but a continuing collision of two mutually parasitic phenomena: the irresistible force of popular discontent and distrust in not just government, but public institutions generally, with the exception of the military, on the one hand, and that colliding against an immovable object of partisan polarization on the other, which has been steadily broadening and deepening with every successive year over the past three decades. I think Maurice Fiorina put it well recently when he said, quote, "Our country is not poised on the abyss of race war, civil war, or any other kind of domestic war. Nor are we sliding down a slippery slope towards fascism. Normal people, also known as the general public, continue to live their lives as they did before the election. The voters changed little between 2012 and 2016, although the small changes that occurred were critical for the outcome. Many of Trump's voters were not endorsing his draconian proposals so much as sending a message that they were unhappy with the direction of current policy. Finally, many, if not most Americans, thought that the parties had given them a historically poor choice. Believing that change was needed, just enough of them, in just the right places, rolled the dice to send the candidate of the status quo down to defeat. The third element then expanding on that, it seems to me, is that the story of American politics has not been populism, even though that is what is covered incessantly on this side of the pond and on the other, it's polarisation. Polarisation remains a story. It's like, if you like, populism is kind of Better Call Saul spin-off from Breaking Bad. Very interesting, but still not as good, not as classic, not as relevant, ultimately. And so I think what you can look at in terms of what has happened over the last 12 months is to raise a counterfactual question, which is to say that putting the rhetoric aside, and I know that the rhetoric is important and shouldn't necessarily be dismissed, but putting the rhetoric aside, what exactly has the Trump administration done that a President Rubio, a President Cruz, or a President Bush would not have done? We've had a Faustian bargain between the so-called insurgent populist Trump and the Republican Party, but almost all of the outcome in policy terms, in appointment terms, have been largely orthodox conservative outcomes, from the appointment of Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court, to the deregulatory measures within the executive branch, with possible marginal exceptions on foreign policy. But even on foreign policy, there are a number of arguments that suggest it has been pretty much, you know, more or less what you would have expected, with partial exceptions on trade, the Paris Climate Agreement. And that leads, I think, finally to the fourth element here, which is populism in power. It does seem to me, I mean, drawing on what the other two colleagues have said, that if you look at something that we can perhaps assess in comparative terms, it's what do populists in power actually do? And my reading of literature suggests that there are three strategies they usually pursue once they get into office: state colonization, mass clientelism, and systematic repression. And the United States Constitution and institutions pose powerful obstacles to all of those strategies for populists to employ. A genuine constitutional crisis seems to me to require a disagreement about constitutional obligations that it's impossible to resolve via constitutional means. And in that sense, although some might quibble with that definition as perhaps being too restrictive and setting the bar too high, but if you agree with that definition, the only genuine constitutional crisis that the United States has faced was the Civil War. Other crises, be they impeachment or other issues, have actually involved constitutional dimensions but have been resolved by constitutional means. And at this stage, then, it seems to me also that, as Eric Posner has argued recently, again, while Trump has made rhetorical assaults on the Constitution, and while we may yet find out that he has indeed violated the Constitution, whether through obstruction of justice, whether through collusion, or whether through his own business elements in the Emoluments Clause, at the moment, identifying actual violations of the Constitution is much more difficult than is commonly assumed. Posner put it, I think, rather provocatively, but to me persuasively, like this. He said, while Trump disparaged judges, called the media the enemy of the people, praised torture, and compared the intelligence community to Nazis, he did not act on those statements. Unlike Franklin D. Roosevelt, he hasn't tried to pack the United States Supreme Court. Some would argue he doesn't need to. Unlike Barack Obama, he hasn't yet targeted journalists in leak investigations. Unlike George W. Bush, he hasn't actually taken a page from the Nazis by ordering the intelligence community to use coercive interrogation. However unwise or injudicious many of his actions on immigration, trade, climate change and more, these fell within his legal and constitutional authority. And indeed, if he wants to get re-elected, something which I don't think anyone should dismiss prematurely in this room, or after November this year, he needs cooperation with the other branches within the constitutional framework to get things done. In the old hackneyed phrase, Trump isn't changing Washington so much as Washington. changing Trump in substance, if not symbolism. It seems to me, then, in conclusion, that Trumpism, to the extent one can identify any serious populist elements beyond rhetorical nods to his base, Trumpism is unlikely to survive the reality checks and balances, rendering it more a political tremor than an earthquake. And in that sense, it's only the latest iteration of a phenomenon Tom Wolfe rather dryly commented about some years ago in terms of American intellectuals' views of incipient authoritarianism, one of the unexplained political phenomena of modern astronomy, namely that the dark night of fascism is always descending in the United States and yet lands only in Europe.
Excellent. Well, we have half an hour for questions and discussion, and it will only be half an hour because at 8 o'clock we can all go outside and join the very generous reception to lift a glass to Fred Halliday's memory, but also to carry on the discussion. So who would like to have the first intervention? Yes, you. Yeah, put your hand up high so the mic can come to you. Thanks.
Thanks very much for your talk. I'm a student here at LSE. From what we've learned so far is that populism really does threat to the democracy. And then what you've mentioned just now about the Freedom House report, that it did indicate that the global decline in democracy is related to populism. So looking forward, how do you see, is there any trend that the trend will be reversed?
Right. Is there anyone else who wants to join this first round of questions? Or we're all being a bit shy? All right. Well, let's start with Rob and work our way back, because I don't think you think that Trump's rhetoric is a threat to American democracy. But do you think the Trump trend, whatever it is, can be reversed?
What's the Trump trend?
Ah, well, I was hoping you'd ask them that.
I mean, if what we're talking about, I mean, to take your premise of the question, obviously, as you go from my little spiel, I don't accept the premise in the American case. I don't think democracy is dying. I don't think it's even under threat in the United States. Quite the contrary. I think that actually what you're seeing is a reinvigoration of the Constitution, which typically happens when there are challenges to established modes of doing it. If what we mean by the Trump threat is things like nativist appeals, xenophobic appeals, racist, sexist, homophobic appeals, I expect, you know, they're probably going to continue, but Trump didn't invent them. They preceded him. And again, to go back to the polarization argument here, there's an issue, I think, about the racialization of American politics, the extent to which the Republican Party sees its short to midterm future as being one of white nationalism, and whether that remains viable or not. For the short term, it seems that they think it is viable, or at least they're keeping that pact with the devil. So I think in those terms, it's unlikely that you're going to see that kind of rhetoric disappear. And also on the other side, I think it's also important on the other side to remember that, you know, we shouldn't sort of view the kind of Democratic Party base with rose-tinted spectacles here. I mean, you know, it was in the 2000s that Bush was described as Hitler, by groups like Move On and so forth, and Code Pink. So, you know, no one has a monopoly on that kind of rhetoric. I think the issue becomes how much that is deemed to be an electoral albatross or an asset. And, you know, probably, you know, one would imagine on the left it's going to be, you know, the rhetoric will be, as you saw about the rather peculiar reception to Oprah Winfrey the other week, that, oh, you know, we will go back to the Obama unifying rhetoric and so forth. But, you know, there are tensions on that too. And it's not at all clear, as I said, also at the moment, if you look at the opinion surveys, one of the most notable things over recent weeks has been the narrowing of the generic party vote in the midterm election. So the Democrats had a substantial lead. It's narrowed down, I think, to around about 5 points in the most recent polls. That's pretty significant. It's suggesting that actually Trump's rhetoric certainly may not be attracting any independents, but it's certainly not turning away his base. And after all, effectively, if you look back to 2016, Democrats Democrats coalesced around their candidate, Republicans coalesced around their, and that dynamic, I don't think, is going to disappear.
So, Muku, you accused the BJP or documented the BJP's attack on diversity, on institutionalism. They are a threat to democracy. But I'm wondering, having that they were got elected on a minority vote, is the trend reversible in India?
Well, I'd like to, most of my work, in fact, has, until 2 years ago, I've been, continue to be optimistic. But the Indian electorate has been a very canny electorate. It's voted incumbent governments out of power repeatedly. And people like voting. So turnouts go up every election. So I think there is something to be said about the electorate, and I'll come back to that at the end. Now, Narendra Modi and Amit Shah, they're a dual act. Right? They have turned elections, winning elections, into an end in itself, it seems to me. You win elections to gain power in order to do something. But at the moment, their agenda is to win as many elections as they can, and the way Indian democracy works, there are three tiers of democracy. And the first tier is national government. The second tier is there are 29 states in India, provinces, regions, and each of them have their own governments. And the BJP would like, part of their anti-diversity agenda is that there should be no political competition. They want to win every single election because it's representatives from these regions who form the upper house. So in order to pass any legislation, they need majority in both the lower house, which they have already through the national elections, and then they need majority in the upper house, which they'll win through the provincial elections. Now, what they want to do with this power is still unclear, apart from bringing in constitutional amendments to literally change the texture of India's imagination as a republic. So changes in citizenship laws, who can be a citizen of India for the first time is being changed to be determined by religion, such that the only religion that is missing from it is Islam. Right? So that's quite a fundamental blow at a foundational idea of how India is imagined. Now the hope, and one has to live in hope, and I think democracies also are about hope because that's what sort of keeps the wheel turning, is that 2019, the next elections are coming up, and they are doing everything to make sure that the electoral process is muddied further. And again, I won't go into details here unless somebody wants to talk about it. But their lack of performance on the things they promised on has been so stark. And the last budget that came out last week, which is the final budget before the next elections, is so bad in terms of addressing unemployment and rural distress. These are the two big issues in India at the moment, and it's done very little. The Prime Minister's trip to Davos, where he made a very clear plea saying India is open for business, come and invest, we need foreign investment. In India, that was his message, we are open. Yeah? That was exactly contradicted in the budget where custom duties have been put up from 15% to 20%, etc. It's just, and so the economic growth that is required, economic growth is falling, that is required to deliver on the things that were promised in 5 years, simply it's difficult to see how they will. So the only hope one can have is that this electorate, which has been very good at throwing governments out, will hopefully do the same. But it's a bit like Trump. This is a man who's made plans to stay. Much more like Trump, actually, much more than Trump. And it's very interesting to hear Robin speak. I always say that, when Trump came on the scene, people thought this was the first time they were confronting it. Narendra Modi, many ways, is a past master at the game. That is being, and because the robustness of the institutions is much more fragile in India because they're younger, they're 70 years old, this is a big test for those institutional structures. But he plans to stay. So really now our only hope is not the institutions, it's not the media, it is lack of investment and a largely poor electorate being politically savvy, as they usually are.
No, if there's nothing to worry about in America and there's some goal for optimism and rising vote in India, it strikes me that the problem in Turkey is much more historically continuous, and that you've had a populist, anti-democratic run through. So is it a threat to democracy? I assume you say yes. And can the trend be overturned? Or how can the trend be overturned?
Well, we talk about authoritarian populism, it's actually quite different than the kind of populism of Trump or the sort of populist trend in Europe, or what happened in this country with Brexit. Because in countries where there are checks and balances and strong institutions, things can be balanced and checked. And when the populace changes its view, there are ways of registering it and responding to it. Whereas in Turkey, when we are talking about authoritarian populism, all these checks and balances have been removed. Therefore, like in Iran, slightly different case, but like in Iran, like in various other countries in Latin America, I think Turkey will take long time to reverse some of the damage that's been done to its institutions. You know, it's not a matter of changing governments and leaders. It's actually trying to repair the damage that has been caused. I mean, how long does it take to bring up the quality of education to an acceptable level that a country like Turkey, which claims to be one of the world's first and biggest economies, to compete and cope with demands of world economy. How long does it take to get women back into employment when you have, when one of the biggest problems in recent years is underage marriage? And the biggest institution right now in Turkey, which has a bigger budget than several key ministries combined, is the Religious Affairs Directorate. And the last statement that they put out yesterday was that you should teach your children not to eat with their left hand, because only the devil eats with the left hand. I mean, This is something we laugh it off, but actually these are really important things. The same directorate a month or so ago had an index, admittedly not a statement, said that it was perfectly normal and acceptable for 9-year-old girls to get married. I mean, the country is already facing huge problems with Syrian refugees having to marry off their daughters out of necessity, the increased Islamic conservatism in society is already pushing women to edges of society. So all these things are very difficult to repair, even if you change governments, even if you change constitutions. So once authoritarian regimes, populist or otherwise, are entrenched, it's very difficult to push them out of the way. Now, when we talk about, it doesn't really matter if Trump says something, that there are checks and balances to make it irrelevant. Actually, I was reading this morning an article by a colleague from Azerbaijan, talking about Mehman Aliyev, who is the editor and founder of the only independent news agency in Azerbaijan, Turan News Agency. He was offered various bribes by the government and refused them, and he is probably the only independent, credible voice left. Therefore, he had to be found guilty of tax evasion, and he was duly put in jail. And this article was about, by Alex Raufall, by the way, was about how he sat in a jail in Azerbaijan and overheard a television set saying, government is saying, fake news, fake news. The Washington Post had an article about Mehman Aliyev's jail sentence. And they were all shouting, fake news, like Trump said, Washington Post is a fake news site. It doesn't matter what they say about Azerbaijan. We don't take it seriously. I mean, these things really matter. When the U.S. president talks, the rest of the world either listens or, worse, copies or takes encouragement from it. So any kind of populism that, as we describe one way or another, I think is harmful to varying degrees, depending what sort of country that we are talking about, how strong their institutions are, and how much some of the damage could be reversed in a reasonable time. I would say, resist it while it's small and resistible.
Thank you. I think, Chris, do you have a question? Yeah, and then we'll come down here. So the first question at the back, Professor Chris Brown.
It's kind of a statement, which I'll say, do you agree at the end, to make it a question? I'd like to go back to the way you framed it, Toby, at the beginning when talking about Fred. And you said Fred was a cosmopolitan. I don't think Fred was a cosmopolitan. He was an internationalist. And I think there's quite a big difference between the two. I mean, Fred was a socialist, and he knew that where socialism has been successful, it's where the socialist or social democrats have associated themselves with the nation, with the community. They have become the representation of it. I mean, that's what happens in the Labour Party in 45. It happens in Swedish, Scandinavian social democracy, and so on. And getting to the point, I mean, it seems to me one of the reasons for the rise of populism is the way that the left and the liberal left has kind of abandoned the idea of the nation. It's abandoned the idea of the community. It doesn't think in those terms anymore, but ordinary people in the street still do. And so something like Make America Great Again, or the Brexit campaign, or AfD in Germany, what they're doing is appealing to a sense of the nation, and their opponents haven't had the language to oppose them effectively, because they no longer use that kind of language. They regard that kind of language as atavistic. The basically, if you talk about the nation, you're some kind of extreme right-wing figure. And I think Fred knew that that wasn't the case. And his internationalism was exactly that. It was internationalisms rather than cosmopolitanism. And I think one of the reasons for the rise of populism is that cosmopolitanism has taken over a large part of liberal left ideology. So I'll say, do you agree? And then it becomes...
Okay, and yes, if we come down, the lady with the white jumper.
Hi, thank you. I was really interested in the comment made about Canada versus Japan and how the different policies, Canada being welcoming to immigrants and being liberal and whatnot versus Japan, how that affects the sentiments within the people or amongst the people, because being in the U.S. at the time of the election, it was a very, there was a strong focus on the racial differences, class differences and whatnot. And so I'm wondering, and I don't know if there's a correct answer to this, but what drives the acceptance in Canada versus negligence in U.S.?
Thank you. Yes, and the gentleman in the black glasses, don't you think?
Just a quick question for Robert. Take the point about the impact of sort of Trump maybe being not seen as much when you acknowledge he's kind of so thus far stayed within the constraints of the Constitution. But I wonder what your views are when it comes to foreign affairs, and in particular, given that that would seem to be one area of the Constitution where the president has more leeway. And so I wonder what your view is on sort of America first. You know, is this something different, or is this just for you the continuation of Barack Obama's post-American foreign policy? You know, is this an area where we actually see real change, and is it for you significant?
And I think the final question, Katerina. Yeah.
Does it work?
Yeah.
Sorry. The relationship between populism and class is a very interesting one. And I wanted to ask all three if you could add some meat on the bones with regards to that. It seems to me, of course, different issues apply in the three cases, but I think we need to bring the question of class into this discussion in a scholarly manner.
Right, so we have four questions, and we'll start at the other end and come back. I'll have to think more about Chris's definition of Fred and nationalism, but the central question is it the abandonment of nationalism by the liberal left that have given rise to populism? Thank you. And then the second is about race and class in the US and Canada, Japan example you gave. And then America first, and then populism and class. So pick up any or all of those apart from the ones that were addressed to you. Should we start with Turkey?
I mean, do you want me to limit myself to
You Turkey? Don't have to, no.
Well, just a short comment about not listening to nation. I think for rise of populism, it is a hugely important issue that people don't take what they say at face value and listen to them, and B, they do not develop counter arguments and counter solutions to problems. We saw that in Britain during the Brexit debate. A lot of people actually also didn't take Trump seriously. I have to say, I did write at the time both for Trump's chances of winning and for Brexit happening, that I actually believed towards the end especially that it would happen because people who objected it didn't develop strong enough counter-arguments, they did not take them seriously, and there was always a bit of an arrogance and kind of dismissive attitude, and that's very counterproductive, very dangerous in any country, be it an authoritarian type of populism we're talking about, or more reversible. But I mean, even what we say in a more reversible type of societies where there are institutions to moderate and balance things, it's actually not that easy to reverse things. Who thinks that Brexit could be that easily reversible now, at this stage? Populism and class, if I limit myself to Turkey for that one, and being no academic, I probably won't give you a satisfying answer in academic terms, Katerina, but in Turkey, there's been so much pressure and oppression of various class-based activities over the past 4 or 5 decades. In fact, most of the military coups happened in Turkey to oppress a class-based activity. If you look at the 1980 coup, that was the time where you really saw class coming into struggle in Turkey, the left, the right, and others. And the workers were out on the streets. They were striking and doing things. And the military coup basically did two things, apart from ending the violence, which was completely getting out of hand, but it ended the class struggle, particularly the leftist. But also it made it possible for neoliberal economic programs that mildly effective and not so strong coalition governments could put into place. So in Turkey, it's slightly different. When you look at AKP, for example, their base pretty much envelopes everybody, but mostly now no longer just rural populations. The Islamists actually get most of their vote from big cities and shanty towns and urban poor. Except in the last referendum, we saw that they lost quite a bit of support in the biggest three cities. But so their base is pretty much of all classes. And in fact, in Turkey now, really the elite, if there is any elite, secular elite that we can sort of talk about that can influence things, is kind of neutral. That's due to pressures on their businesses and things. But so there's no such class element that I can show you that either supports or stands against the populism. And one of the biggest problems also with populists becoming dominant power in any country is that they force other political parties and groups and movements to act like populists, because otherwise they get nowhere. So it encourages populism, encourages more populism, and that's the case in Turkey.
Maku?
Just picking up on that, on class, I think there is something to be said. You can't get a populist wave of support unless you're cutting through class. In Modi's case, if you break down his support base that voted for him, it was overwhelmingly small traders, urban, upper caste Hindu vote that went to him. This was the 31%. Interestingly, it is his economic policies and his demonetization, his infamous demonetization, where he discontinued the use of the two most popular notes, nearly 90% of the circulating currency, has hit precisely the base that he was, that was his supporters, and this new national tax that he's brought in, goods and services tax. What is interesting, though, is the political spin on demonetization, for instance, has been so effective that you talk to, where I do my research, is in a really quite ordinary rural setting in one of the states of India, and people will tell you that, well, at least the man tried. You know, so it was as a political gesture, as an economic solution, it was rubbish. It was a complete and utter failure. But the politics of it was so well spun that there was a political message that appealed. You know, it was masterful, because through the 500 and 1,000 rupee note, in a country of 1.6 billion, there are not many gestures that you can do that will get to literally every citizen. And this was one of them. So it was politically masterful. You know, so this is a very canny operator at work. Whether the economic policy is actually going to boomerang is something that we'll have to see in 12 months' time. But it is across, right from the elites to the poor. Chris's question, I mean, the answer, the short and vehement answer to your "do you agree" is a yes. I think, again, the Indian case is a very good way to examine this issue of nationalism. Oh, no, I agree with you. It's not even nationalism. It's a commitment to the nation versus, you know, the citizens of nowhere kind of cosmopolitanism that Theresa May was appealing to or denigrating. The irony in the Indian case, it's very stark, because this is the reason I mentioned the RSS that the Prime Minister belongs to. The RSS actually did not fight for Indian independence. They never agreed to salute the Indian flag. I mean, they're not nationalists. They're not people who fought for independence. And they have been able to claim the ground of nationalism because, you're absolutely right, you see this in India, there's a squeamishness about nationalism, somehow that it's a bit wet and a bit sentimental, which has ceded ground to the right on this. And the other twinning thing with, of course, is the issue of religion, which, you know, we've seen in each of the three contexts where it's so important, whatever the religion, and each of the, you know, the three examples are three different religions. But again, the inability to articulate a secular religious language which has been the biggest failure of the liberal project, that there is no comfortable liberal way to talk about religion, which would actually resonate with the vernacular practice of religion. People who are religious are not necessarily extremists. And often people, that's why I made the point about Hindutva, that it's an appropriation of Hinduism for a political project, which actually bears very little resemblance to the practice of Hinduism. The bigger irony in this tension between the squeamishness with the nation and cosmopolitanism is that I would say the zeitgeist that probably ties these three cases together is that actually the problems that are being faced, whether it's the anti-globalization rhetoric in the US or, you know, in each context, there is, the crisis is a global crisis. The financialization of the economy has created global financial capital for which you need global solutions. And the internationalism or the the cosmopolitanism of the liberal has no solutions for that. And when you come up, there are voices who are, you know, there's a fantastic economist in Chicago who's offering a way in which central banks across the world can coordinate their activities to, he gave a lecture at LSE, in fact, last year, in order to deal with this kind of international solution. Those are the kind of solutions that is going to beef up the liberal voice, not some sort of deracinated squeamishness about religion and singing the anthem. Thank you.
Rob, we're coming to the end, so we'll leave the last word to you.
Oh, good. Three quick points in relation to Chris's point. I emphatically, yes, agree with you entirely. In fact, I go further. I wouldn't just say it's about nationalism, I would say it's about identity politics more generally. And the rise of identity politics on the left, for all of its benefits, is undoubtedly getting a large reaction on the right, which now sees their identity politics, white identity politics, nationalist identity politics, as equally legitimate. On the candidate issue, I don't know entirely. My sort of suspicion for the difference partly is just the scale. You know, America is facing becoming a majority-minority nation, so that is looming very large there in a way that it's not for the Canadians. The Canadians, in terms of the history, also it's fundamentally different there. So I think that there's a dissociation there. But I think also there is this element of what you, referring to the race and class issue, I thought it was significant in the election in 2016. You know, there was an expectation, for example, that Clinton would finally do something that Democrats, Obama hadn't managed to do, which is win whites with college degrees. She didn't. Trump not only got them, as well as every other cohort of white voter, or every other demographic, income, education levels, you name it. So there's something very, very significant there. And part of that also, though, is you know, without going the sort of he's a racist argument, is to note that part of those demographics that gave him the victory in some of those upper Midwestern states, had voted for Obama in 2008-2012. They didn't become racists over the intervening 4 years. And the final point on the American First point. I think it's a difficult one because there really wasn't much support for his agenda, even among the Republican base, and even in some instances among his core supporters. According to Chicago surveys over the last couple of years, for example, they did support him on things like jobs issues, but not on NATO, not on alliances, and so forth. And he's now been criticised by people like Stephen Walt, who are saying, well, what's changed? You know, fundamentally, most of this is similar to what was going on previously. You've had the surge in Afghanistan, you've had special forces in Syria, you've had increased drone attacks in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and elsewhere. There have been some changes, certainly on things like, you know, the tilt towards Israel and the Sunni states. That's significant. But in some ways, I think the most interesting question is not how far he's gone, but why he's been held back. Because if you supported him on his America First agenda, you should by now be extremely disappointed at actually him resembling, in large part, albeit with much less decorous language, his predecessor. And the only sort of, I think, distinguishing element there is we're only in 1 year, and clearly a lot of his agenda has been, foreign policy agenda has been filtered through a domestic lens. a lot of the way he looks at the world is in terms of what did Obama do? I don't like it. I'm going to do something different. And there are two different sort of Trump foreign policies. There's the teleprompter Trump foreign policy, which is in the national security strategy documents and the official documents. And then there's the tweet Trump impetuous, no idea what can happen overnight. So sort of describing the Trump foreign policy kind of in a way begs the question, what is it?
Right, that's a good way to end. First, I'd like to thank you all for turning out on this very cold and wintry night. And as part of the beneficence and wonderment that is the International Relations Department, we have wine and food outstairs to thank you, and also to toast the memory of Fred Halliday. But more importantly, I'd like to thank our three speakers who've given us a feast. Thank you very much, and please join us for drinks outside.